Daggers and stabbed it suggests cruel murder. Observe how cleverly Antony injects this suggestion into his speech, and observe also how quickly the mob catches its significance, because unknown to the mob, Antony has carefully prepared their minds to receive this suggestion. Fourth citizen, they were traitors, honorable men. All, the will, the testament. Second citizen, they were villains, murderers, the will. Just what Antony would have said in the beginning, but he knew it would have had more desirable effect if he planted the thought in all the minds of the mob and permitted them to say it in themselves. Antony, you will compel me then to read the will? Then make a ring about the corpse of Caesar, and let me show you him that made the will. Shall I descend, and will you give me leave? This was a point at which Brutus should have begun to look for a back door through which to make his escape. All, come down. Second citizen, descend. Third citizen, room for Antony, most noble Antony. Antony, nay, press not so much upon me, stand far off. He knew this command would make them want to draw near, which is what he wanted them to do. All, stand back, room. Antony, if you have tears, prepare to shed them now. You all do know this mantle, I remember. The first time ever Caesar put it on. 'Twas on a summer evening in this tent, that day he overcame the Nervi. Look in this place, ran Cassius dagger through. See what a rent the envious Casca made. Through this the well-beloved Brutus stabbed, and as he plucked his cursed steel away, mark how the blood of Caesar followed it, as rushing out the door to be resolved, if Brutus so unkindly knocked or no, for Brutus, as you know, was Caesar's angel. Judge, O you gods, how dearly Caesar loved him. This was the most unkindest cut of all. For when the noble Caesar saw him stab, in gratitude more strong than traitor's arms, quiet vanquished him, then burst his mighty heart, and in his mantle muffling up his face, even at the base of Pompey's statue, which all the while ran blood, great Caesar fell. Oh, what a fall was there, my countrymen! Then I and you and all of us fell down, while bloody treason flourished over us. Oh, now you weep, and I perceive you fail the dint of pity, these of gracious drops. Kind soul, why weep you when you but behold our Caesar's vesture wounded? Look you here. Here is himself, marred as you see with traitors. Observe how Antony now uses the words traitors quite freely, because he knows that it is in harmony with that which is the minds of the Roman mob. First citizen, O piteous spectacle! O woeful day! O woeful day! O most bloody sight! We will be revenged! Had Brutus been a wise man instead of a braggart, he would have been many miles from the scene at this time. All, revenge, about, seek, burn, kill, fire, slay, let not a traitor live. Here Antony takes the next step towards crystallizing the frenzy of the mob into action, but clever salesman that he is, does not try to force this action. Antony, stay, countrymen. First citizen, peace there, hear the noble Antony. Second citizen, we will hear him, we will follow him, we'll die with him. From these words, Antony knows that he has the mob with him. Observe how he takes advantage of this psychological moment, the moment from which all master salesmen wait. Antony, good friends, sweet friends, let me not stir you up to such a sudden flood of mutiny. They that have done this deed are honorable. What private griefs they have, alas, I know not. They made them do it. They were wise and honorable, and will, no doubt, with reasons answer you. I come not, friends, to steal away your hearts. I am no orator, as Brutus is. But as you know me all, a plain, blunt man, that love my friend, and that they know full well, that gave me public leave to speak of him. For I have neither wit, nor words, nor worth, action nor utterance, nor the power of speech, to stir men's blood. I only speak right on. I tell you that which you selves do know. Show you sweet Caesar's wounds, poor, poor, dumb mouths, and bid them speak for me, but were I Brutus, and Brutus Antony, there are Antony, would ruffle up your spirits and put a tongue in every wound of Caesar's that should move the stones of Rome to rise in mutiny. All. Will mutiny, first citizen, will burn the houses of Brutus, third citizens, away then, come seek the conspirators. Antony, yet hear me, countrymen, yet hear me speak. All. Peace, ho, hear Antony, most noble Antony. Antony, why, friends, you go to do you know not what. Wherein hath Caesar thus deserved your love? Alas, you know not, I must tell you then. You have forgot the will I told you of. Antony is now ready to play his trump card. He is ready to reach his climax. Observe how well he has marshaled his suggestions, step by step, saving until his last important statement, the one on which he relied for action. In the great field of salesmanship and in public speaking, many a man tries to reach this point too soon, tries to rush his audience or his prospective purchaser, and thereby loses his appeal. All. Most true, the will. Let's stay and hear the will. Antony. Here is the will, and under Caesar's seal. To every Roman citizen he gives, to several men, 75 drachmas. Second citizen. Most noble Caesar will revenge his death. Third citizen. O royal Caesar. Antony. Hear me with patience. All. Peace, ho. Antony. Moreover, he have left you all his walks, his private arbors and new planted orchards. On this side Tiber, he hath left them you, and to your heirs forever, common pleasures, to walk abroad and recreate yourself. Here was a Caesar, when comes such another. First citizen. Never, never, come, away, away. We'll burn his body in the holy place, and with the brands fire the traitors' houses, take up the body. Second citizen. Go fetch fire. Third citizen. Pluck down benches. Fourth citizen. Pluck down forms, windows, anything. And that was Brutus' finish. He lost his case because he lacked the personality and the good judgment with which to present his argument from the viewpoint of the Roman mob, as Mark Antony did. His whole attitude clearly indicated that he thought pretty well of himself, that he was proud of his deed. We have all seen people in this day and time who somewhat resemble Brutus in this respect. But if we observe closely, we notice that they did not accomplish very much. Suppose that Mark Antony had mounted the platform in a strutting attitude and had begun his speech in this wise. Now let me tell you, Romans, something about this man Brutus. He is a murderer at heart, and he would have gone no further, for the mob would have howled him down. Clever salesman and practical psychologist that he was, Mark Antony so presented his case that it appeared not to be his own idea at all, but that of the Roman mob itself. Go back to the lesson on initiative and leadership and read it again. And as you read, compare the psychology of it with that of Mark Antony's speech. Observe how the you and not I attitude towards others was emphasized. Observe, if you please, how this same point is emphasized throughout the course, and especially in Lesson 7 on Enthusiasm. Shakespeare was by far the most able psychologist and writer known to civilization. For that reason, all of his writings are based upon unerring knowledge of the human mind. Throughout this speech, which he placed in the mouth of Mark Antony, you will observe how carefully he assumed the you attitude. So carefully that the Roman mob was sure that its decision was on its own making. I must call your attention, however, to the fact that Mark Antony's appeal to the self-interest of the Roman mob was of the crafty type, and was based upon the stealth with which dishonest men often make use of this principle in appealing to the cupidity and avarice of their victims. While Mark Antony displayed evidence of great self-control in being able to assume, at the beginning of his speech, an attitude toward Brutus that was not real, At the same time, it is obvious that his entire appeal was based upon his knowledge of how to influence the minds of the Roman mob through flattery. The two letters reproduced in Lesson 7 of this course illustrate in a very concrete way the value of the you and the fatality of the I appeal. Go back and read these letters again and observe how the more successful of the two follows closely to Mark Antony's appeal, while the other one is based upon an appeal of just the opposing nature. Whether you are writing a sales letter or preaching a sermon or writing an advertisement or a book, you will do well to follow the same principles employed by Mark Antony in his famous speech. Now let us turn our attention to the study of ways and means through which one may develop a pleasing personality. Let us start with the first essential, which is character. For no one may have a pleasing personality without the foundation of a sound, positive character. Through the principle of telepathy, you telegraph the nature of your character to those with whom you come in contact, which is responsible for what you have often called an intuitive feeling that the person whom you have just met, but about whom you did not know very much, was not trustworthy. You may embellish yourself with clothes of the neatest and latest design, and conduct yourself in the most pleasing manner as far as outside appearances go. But if there is greed and envy and hatred and jealousy and avarice and selfishness in your heart, you will never attract any, except those characters which harmonize with your own. Like attracts like, and you may be sure, therefore, that those who are attracted to you are those whose inward natures parallel your own. You may embellish yourself with an artificial smile that belies your feelings, and you may practice the art of handshaking so that you can imitate perfectly the handshake of the person who is an adept at this art. But if these outward manifestations of an attractive personality lack that vital factor called earnestness of purpose, they will repel instead of attract. How, then, may one build character? The first step in character building is rigid self-discipline. In both the second and eighth lesson of this course, you will find the formula through which you may shape your character after any pattern that you choose. But I repeat it here, as it is based upon a principle that will bear much repetition as follows. First, select those whose characters were made up of the qualities which you wish to build into your own character, and then proceed in the manner described in Lesson 2 to appropriate these qualities through the aid of autosuggestion. Create in your imagination a council table and gather your characters around it each night, first having written out a clear, concise statement of the particular qualities that you wish to appropriate from each. Then proceed to affirm or suggest to yourself, in outspoken, audible words, that you are developing the desired qualities in yourself. As you do this, close your eyes and see in your imagination the figures seated around your imaginary table, in the manner described in Lesson 2. Second, through the principles described in Lesson 8 on self-control, control your thoughts and keep your mind vitalized with thoughts of a positive nature. Let the dominating thought of your mind be a picture of that person that you intend to be, the person that you are deliberately building through this procedure. At least a dozen times a day, when you have a few minutes to yourself, shut your eyes and direct your thoughts to the figures which you have selected to sit on your imaginary council table, and feel, with a faith that knows no limitation, that you are actually growing to resemble in character those figures of your choice. Third, find at least one person each day, and more if possible, in whom you see good quality that is worthy of praise, and praise it. Remember, however, that this praise must not be in the nature of cheap, insincere flattery. It must be genuine. Speak your words of praise with such earnestness that they will impress those to whom you speak. Then watch what happens. You will have rendered those whom you praise a decided benefit of great value to them, and you will have gone just one more step in the direction of developing the habit of looking for and finding the good qualities in others. I cannot emphasize the far-reaching effects of this habit of praising, openly and enthusiastically, the good qualities in others. For this habit will soon reward you with a feeling of self-respect and manifestation of gratitude from others. that will modify your entire personality. Here again, the law of attraction enters, and those whom you praise will see in you the qualities that you see in them. Your success in the application of this formula will be in exact proportion to your faith in its soundness. I do not merely believe that it is sound, I know that it is. And the reason I know is that I have used it successfully, and I have also taught others how to use it successfully. Therefore, I have a right to promise you that you can use it with equal success. Furthermore, you can, with the aid of this formula, develop an attractive personality so speedily that you will surprise all who know you. The development of such a personality is entirely within your control, a fact which gives you a tremendous advantage and at the same time places upon you the responsibility if you fail or neglect to exercise your privilege. I now wish to direct your attention to the reason for speaking aloud the affirmation that you are developing the desired qualities which you have selected as the materials out of which to develop an attractive personality. This procedure has two desirable effects, namely, first, it sets into motion the vibration through which the thought back of your word reaches and embeds itself into your subconscious mind, where it takes root and grows until it becomes a great moving force in your outward physical activities, leading in the direction of transformation of the thought into reality. Second, it develops in you the ability to speak with force and conviction, which will lead finally to great ability as a public speaker. No matter what your calling in life may be, you should be able to stand upon your feet and speak convincingly, as this is one of the most effective ways of developing an attractive personality. Put feeling and emotion into your words as you speak, and develop a deep, rich tone of voice. If your voice is inclined to be high-pitched, tone it down until it is soft and pleasing. You can never express an attractive personality to the best advantage through a harsh or shrill voice. You must cultivate your voice until it becomes rhythmical and pleasing to the ear. Remember that speech is the chief method of expressing your personality, and for this reason it is to your advantage to cultivate a style that is both forceful and pleasing. I do not recall a single outstanding attractive personality that was not made up in part of ability to speak with force and conviction. Study the prominent men and women of today, wherever you find them, and observe the significant fact that the more prominent they are, the more effective and efficient are they in speaking forcefully. Study the outstanding figures of the past in politics and statesmanship, and observe that the most successful ones were those who were noted for their ability to speak with force and conviction. In the field of business, industry, and finance, it seems significant also that the most prominent leaders are men and women who are able to publicly speak. In fact, no one may hope to become a prominent leader in any noteworthy undertaking without developing the ability to speak with forcefulness that carries conviction. While the salesman may never deliver a public address, he will profit nevertheless if he develops the ability to do so, because this ability increases his power to talk convincingly in ordinary conversation. Let us now summarize the chief factors which enter into the development of an attractive personality as follows. First, form the habit of interesting yourself in other people, and make it your business to find their good qualities and speak of them in terms of praise. Second, develop the ability to speak with force and conviction, both in your ordinary conversational tones and before public gatherings, where you must use more volume. Third, clothe yourself in a style that is becoming to your physical build and the work in which you are engaged. Fourth, develop a positive character through the aid of the formula outlined in this lesson. Fifth, learn how to shake hands so that you expect warmth of feeling and enthusiasm through this form of greeting. Sixth, attract other people to you by first attracting yourself to them. Seventh, remember that your only limitation within reason is the one which you set up in your own mind. These 7 points cover the most important factors that enter into the development of an attractive personality. But it seems hardly necessary to suggest that such a personality will not develop of its own accord. It will develop if you submit yourself to the discipline herein described, with a firm determination to transform yourself into the person that you would like to be. As I study this list of 7 important factors that enter into the development of an attractive personality, I feel moved to direct your attention to the 2nd and the 4th as being the most important. If you will cultivate these finer thoughts and feelings and actions out of which a positive character is built, and then learn to express yourself with force and conviction, you will have developed an attractive personality. For it will be seen that out of this attainment will come the other qualities here outlined. There is a great power of attraction back of the person who has a positive character, and this power expresses itself through unseen as well as visible sources. The moment you come within speaking distance of such a person, even though not a word is spoken, the influence of the unseen power within makes itself felt. Every shady transaction in which you engage, every negative thought that you think, and every destructive act in which you indulge destroys just so much of that subtle something within you that is known as character. There is full confession in the glances of our eyes, in our smiles and salutations, in the grasp of the hands. His sin bedaubs him, mars all his good impression. Most men know why they not trust him, but they do not trust him. His vice glasses his eyes, demeans his cheek, pinches his nose, sets the mark of beast on the back of his head, and writes, "O fool, O fool," on the forehead of a king. Emerson. I would direct your attention now to the 1st of the 7 factors that enter into the development of an attractive personality. You have observed that all through this lesson, I have gone into lengthy detail to show the material advantages of being agreeable to other people. However, the biggest advantage of all lies not in the possibility of monetary or material gain which this habit offers, but in the beautifying effect that it has upon the character of all who practice it. Acquire the habit of making yourself agreeable, and you profit both materially and mentally. For you will never be as happy in other things way as you will be when you know that you are making others happy. Remove the chips from your shoulders and quit challenging men to engage you in useful arguments. Remember the smoke glasses through which you see what you believe to be the blueness of life, and behold the shining sunlight of friendliness in its stead. Throw away your hammer and quit knocking, for surely you must know that the big prizes of life go to the builders and not the destroyers. The man who builds a house is an artist. The man who tears it down is a junkman. If you are a person with a grievance, the world will listen to your vitriolic ravings, provided it does not see you coming. But if you are a person with a message of friendliness and optimism, it will listen because it wishes to do so. No person with a grievance can be also a person with an attractive personality. The art of being agreeable, just that one simple trait, is the very foundation of all successful salesmanship. I drive my automobile 5 miles into the outskirts of the city to purchase gasoline, which I could procure within 2 blocks of my own garage. Because the man who runs the filling station is an artist, he makes it his business to be agreeable. I go there not because he has cheaper gasoline, but because I enjoy the vitalizing effect of his attractive personality. 50th Street and Broadway in New York, not because I cannot find any other good shoes at the same price, but for the reason that Mr. Cobb, the manager of that particular Regal store, has an attractive personality. While he is fitting me with shoes, he makes it his business to talk to me on subject which he knows to be close to my heart. I do my banking at the Harriman National Bank at 44th Street and 5th Avenue, not because there are not scores of other good banks much nearer my place of business, but for the reason that the tellers and the cashiers and the lobby detective and Mr. Harriman and all of the others with whom I come into contact make it their business to be agreeable. My account is small, but they receive me as though it were large. I greatly admire John D. Rockefeller, Jr., not because he is the son of one of the world's richest men, but for the better reason that he too has acquired the art of being agreeable. In the little city of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, lives M.T. Garvin, a very successful merchant whom I would travel hundreds of miles to visit, not because he is a wealthy merchant, but for the reason that he makes it his business to be agreeable. However, I have no doubt that his material success is closely related to this noble art of affability which he has acquired. I have in my vest pocket a Parker fountain pen, and my wife and children have pens of the same brand, not because they are not other good fountain pens, but for the reason that I have attracted to George S. Parker on account of his habit of being agreeable. My wife takes the Ladies' Home Journal, not because there are not other good magazines of similar nature, but for the reason that we became attracted to the journal several years ago, while Edward Bach was its editor, because he had acquired the art of being agreeable. O ye struggling pilgrims who are searching for the rainbow's end, ye drawers of water and hewers of wood, tarry for a moment by the wayside, and learn a lesson from a successful man or woman who have succeeded because they acquired the art of being agreeable. You can win for a time through ruthlessness and stealth. You can garner in more of this world's goods than you will need by sheer force and shrewd strategy, without taking the time or going to the trouble of being agreeable. But sooner or later you will come to the point in life at which you will feel the pangs of remorse and the emptiness of your well-filled purse. I never think of power and position and wealth that was attained by force without feeling, very deeply, the sentiment expressed by a man whose name I dare not mention, as he stood at the tomb of Napoleon. A little while ago I stood by the grave of the old Napoleon, a magnificent tomb of gilt and gold, fit almost for a deity dead, and gazed upon the sarcophagus of rare and nameless marble, where rest at last the ashes of that restless man. I leaned over the balustrade and thought about the career of the greatest soldier of the modern world. I saw him at Toulon. I saw him walking upon the banks of the Seine, contemplating suicide. I saw him putting down the mob in the streets of Paris. I saw him at the head of the army in Italy. I saw him crossing the bridge at Lodi with the tricolor in his hands. I saw him in Egypt, in the shadows of the pyramids. I saw him conquer the Alps and mingle the eagles of France with the eagles of the crags. I saw him at Marengo, at and at Austerlitz. I saw him in Russia, when the infantry of the snow and the cavalry of the wild blast scattered his legions like winter's withered leaves. I saw him at Leipzig in defeat and disaster, driven by a million bayonets back upon Paris, clutched like a wild beast, banished to Elba. I saw him escape and retake an empire by the force of his genius. I saw him upon the frightful field of Waterloo, where chance and fate combined to wreck the fortunes of their former king. And I saw him at St. Helena, with his hands crossed behind him, gazing out upon the sad and solemn sea. I thought of the widows and orphans he had made, of the tears that had been shed for his glory, and of the only woman who ever loved him, pushed from his heart by the cold hand of ambition. And I said I would rather have been a French peasant and worn wooden shoes. I would rather have lived in a hut with a vine growing over the door and the grapes growing purple in the amorous kisses of the autumn sun. I would rather have been the poor peasant with my wife by my side, knitting as the day died out of the sky, with my children upon my knees and their arms about me. I would rather have been this man and gone down to the tongueless silence of the dreamless dust than to have been the imperial personification of force and murder, known as Napoleon the Great. I leave you with this as the fitting climax for this lesson, the thought of this deathless dissertation on a man who lived by the sword of force and died an ignominious death, an outcast in the eyes of his fellow men, a sore to the memory of civilization, a failure because he did not acquire the art of being agreeable, because he could not or would not subordinate self for the good of his followers. End of lesson. The Law of Success, Lesson 11, Accurate Thought. You can do it if you believe you can. This is at one and the same time the most important, the most interesting, and the most difficult to present lesson of this entire course on the Law of Success. It is important because it deals with a principle which runs through the entire course. It is interesting for the same reason. It is difficult to present for the reason that it will carry the average student far beyond the boundary line of his common experiences and into a realm of thought in which he is not yet accustomed to dwell. Unless you study this lesson with an open mind, you will miss the very keystone to the arc of this course. And without this stone, you can never complete your temple of success. This lesson will bring you a conception of thought which may carry you far above the level to which you have risen by the evolutionary processes to which you have been subjected to in the past. And for this reason, you should not be disappointed if, at first reading, you do not fully understand it. Most of us disbelieve that which we cannot understand, and it is with knowledge of this human tendency in mind that I caution you against closing your mind if you do not grasp all that is in this lesson at the first reading. For thousands of years, men made ships of wood and of nothing else. They used wood because they believed that it was the only substance that would float. But that was because they had not yet advanced far enough in their thinking process to understand the truth that steel will float, and that it is far superior to wood for building of ships. They did not know that anything could float which was lighter than the amount of water it displaced, and until they learned of this great truth, they went on making ships of wood. Until some 25 years ago, most men thought that only the birds could fly. But now we know that man can not only equal the flying of birds, but he can excel it. Men did not know until quite recently that the great open void known as the air is more alive and more sensitive than anything that is on earth. They did not know that the spoken word would travel through the ether with the speed of a flash of lightning, without the aid of wires. How could they know this when their minds had not been unfolded sufficiently to enable them to grasp? The purpose of this lesson is to aid you in so unfolding and expanding your mind that you will be able to think with accuracy. For this unfoldment will open to you a door that leads to all the power you need in completing your temple of success. All through the preceding lessons of this course, you observe that we have dealt with principles which anyone could easily grasp and apply. You will also observe that these principles have been so presented that they lead to success as measured by material wealth. This seemed necessary for the reason that to most people the word success and the word money are synonymous terms. Obviously, the previous lessons of this course were intended for those who look upon worldly things and material wealth as being all that there is to success. Presenting the matter in another way, I was conscious of the fact that the majority of the students of this course would feel disappointed if I pointed out to them a roadway to success that leads through other than the doorways of business and finance. For it is a matter of common knowledge that most men want success that is spelled S-U-C-C-E-S-S. Very well, let those who are satisfied with this standard of success have it, but some there are who will want to go higher up the ladder, in search of success which is measured in other than material standards, and it is for their benefit in particular that this and the subsequent lessons of this course are intended. Accurate thought involves two fundamentals, which all who indulge in it must observe. First, to think accurately, you must separate facts from mere information. There is much information available to you that is not based upon facts. Secondly, you must separate facts into two classes, namely, the important and the unimportant, or the relevant and the irrelevant. Only by doing so can you think clearly. All facts which you can use in the attainment of your definite chief aim are important and relevant. All that you cannot use are unimportant and irrelevant. It is mainly the neglect of some to make this distinction which accounts for the chasm which separates so widely people who appear to have equal ability and who have had equal opportunity. Without going outside of your own circle of acquaintances, you can point to one or more persons who have had no greater opportunity than you have had and who appear to have no more, and perhaps less ability than you, who are achieving far greater success. And you wonder why. Search diligently, and you will discover that all such people have acquired the habit of combining and using the important facts which affect their line of work. Far from working harder than you, they are perhaps working less and with greater ease, by virtue of their having learned the secret of separating the important facts from the unimportant. They have provided themselves with a sort of fulcrum and lever from which they can move with their little fingers loads that you cannot budge with the entire weight of your body. The person who forms the habit of directing his attention to the important facts out of which he is constructing his temple of success thereby provides himself with a power which may be likened to a trip hammer which strikes a 10-ton blow as compared to a tack hammer which strikes a 1-pound blow. If these similes appear to be elementary, you must keep in mind the fact that some of the students of this course have not yet developed the capacity to think in more complicated terms, and to try to force them to do so would be the equivalent of leaving them hopelessly behind. That you may understand the importance of distinguishing before facts and mere information, study that type of man who is guided entirely by that which he hears, the type who is influenced by all the whisperings of the winds of gossip, that accepts without analysis all that he reads in the newspapers and judges others by what their enemies and competitors and contemporaries say about them. Search your circle of acquaintances and pick out one of this type as an example to keep before your mind while we are on this subject. Observe that this man usually begins his conversation with some such term as, "I see by the papers," or "they say." The accurate thinker knows that the newspapers are not always accurate in their reports, and he also knows that "they say" usually carries more falsehood than truth. If you have not risen above the "I see by the papers" and "they say" class, you have still far to go before you become an accurate thinker. Of course, much truth and many facts travel in the guise of idle gossip and newspaper reports, but the accurate thinker will not accept as such all that he sees and hears. This is a point which I feel impelled to emphasize, for the reason that it constitutes the rocks and reefs of which so many people flounder and go down to defeat in the bottomless ocean of false conclusions. In the realm of legal procedure, there is a principle which is called the law of evidence, and the object of this law is to get at the facts. Any judge can proceed with justice to all concerned if he has the facts upon which to base his judgment. But he may play havoc with innocent people if he circumvents the law of evidence and reaches a conclusion or judgment that is based upon hearsay information. The law of evidence varies according to the subject and circumstance with which it is used, but you will not go far wrong if, in the absence of which you know to be facts, you form your judgments on the hypothesis that only that part of the evidence before you, which furthers your own interest without working any hardship on others, is based upon fact. This is a crucial and important point in this lesson, therefore. I wish to be sure that you do not pass it by lightly. Many a man mistakes, knowingly or otherwise, expediency for fact, doing a thing or refraining from doing it, for the sole reason that his action furthers his own interest without consideration as to whether it interferes with the rights of others. No matter how regrettable, it is true that most thinking of today, far from being accurate, is based upon the sole foundation of expediency. It is amazing to the more advanced student of accurate thought how many people there are who are honest when it is profitable to them, but find myriads of facts to justify themselves in following a dishonest course when the course seems to be more profitable or advantageous. No doubt you know people who are like that. The accurate thinker adopts a standard by which he guides himself, and he follows that standard at all times, whether it works always to his immediate advantage or carries him now and then through the fields of disadvantage, as it undoubtedly will. The accurate thinker deals with facts regardless of how they affect his own interest, for he knows that ultimately this policy will bring him out on top, in possession of the object of his definite chief aim in life. He understands the soundness of the philosophy that the old philosopher Croesus had in mind when he said, "There is a wheel on which the affairs of men revolve, and its mechanism is such that it prevents any man from being always fortunate." The accurate thinker has put one standard by which he conducts himself in his intercourse with his fellow men, and that standard is observed by him as faithfully when it brings him temporary disadvantage, as it is when it brings him outstanding advantage. For being an accurate thinker, he knows that, by the law of averages, he will more than regain at some future time that which he loses by applying his standard to his own temporary determinant. You might as well begin to prepare yourself to understand that it requires the staunchest and most unshakable character to become an accurate thinker. For you can see that this is where the reasoning of this lesson is leading. There is a certain amount of temporary penalty attached to accurate thinking. There is no denying this fact. But while this is true, it is also true the compensating reward, in the aggregate, is so overwhelmingly great that you will gladly pay this penalty. In searching for facts, it is often necessary to gather them through the sole source of knowledge and experience of others. It then becomes necessary to examine carefully both the evidence submitted and the person from whom the evidence comes. And when the evidence is of such a nature that it affects the interest of the witness who is giving it, there will be reason to scrutinize it all the more carefully. As witnesses who have an interest in the evidence that you are submitting often yield to the temptation to color and pervert it to protect that interest. If one man slanders another, his remarks should be accepted, if any weight at all, with at least a grain of the proverbial salt of caution, for it is a common human tendency for men to find nothing but evil in those whom they do not like. The man who has attained to the degree of accurate thinking that enables him to speak with his enemy without exaggerating his faults and minimizing his virtue is the exception and not the rule. Some very able men have not yet risen above this vulgar and self-destructive habit of belittling their enemies, competitors, and contemporaries. I wish to bring this common tendency to your attention with all possible emphasis, because it is a tendency that is fatal to accurate thinking. Before you can become an accurate thinker, you must understand and make allowance for the fact that the moment a man or a woman begins to assume leadership in any walk of life, the slanderers begin to circulate rumors and subtle whisperings reflecting upon him and his character. No matter how fine one's character is, or what service he may be engaged in rendering to the world, he cannot escape the notice of those misguided people who delight in destroying instead of building. Lincoln's political enemies circulated the report that he lived with a colored woman. Washington's political enemies circulated a similar report concerning him. Since both Lincoln and Washington were Southern men, this report was undoubtedly regarded by those who circulated it as being at one and the same time the most fitting and degrading one that they could imagine. But we do not have to go back to our first president to find evidence of the slanderous nature with which men are gifted. For they went a step further in paying their tributes to the late President Harding and circulated the report that he had Negro blood in his veins. When Woodrow Wilson came back from Paris with what he believed to be a sound plan for abolishing war and settling international disputes, all except the accurate thinker might have been led to believe by the reports of the They Say chorus that he was a combination of Nero and Judas Iscariot, the little politicians and the cheap politicians, and the interest-paid politicians, and the plain ignorance who did no thinking of their own, all joined in one mighty chorus for the purpose of destroying the one and only man in the history of the world who offered a plan for abolishing war. The slanders killed both Harding and Wilson, murdered them with vicious lies. They did the same to Lincoln, only in a somewhat more spectacular manner, by inciting a fanatic to hasten his death with a bullet. Statesmanship and politics are not the only fields in which the accurate thinker must be on guard against the They Say chorus. The moment a man begins to make himself felt in a field of industry or business, this chorus becomes active. If a man makes a better mousetrap than his neighbor, the world will make a beaten path to his door, no doubt about that. And in the gang that will trail along will be those who come, not to commend, but to condemn and to destroy his reputation. The late John H. Patterson, president of the National Cash Register Company, is a notable example of what may happen to a man who builds a better cash register than that of his neighbor. Yet in the mind of the accurate thinker, There is not one scintilla of evidence to support the vicious reports that Mr. Patterson's competitors circulated about him. As for Wilson and Harding, we may only judge how posterity will view them by observing how it has immortalized the names of Lincoln and Washington. Truth alone endures. All else must pass on with time. The object of these references is not to eulogize those who stand in no particular need of eulogy, but it is to direct your attention to the fact that they say evidence is always subject to the closest scrutiny, and all the more so when it is of a negative or destructive nature. No harm can come from accepting, as fact, hearsay evidence that is constructive, but its opposite, if accepted at all, should be subjected to the closest inspection possible under the available means of applying the law of evidence. As an accurate thinker, it is both your privilege and your duty to avail yourself of facts, even though you must go out of your way to get them. If you permit yourself to be swayed to and fro by all manner of information that comes to your attention, you will never become an accurate thinker. And if you do not think accurately, you cannot be sure of attaining the object of your definite chief aim in life. Many a man has gone down to defeat because, due to his prejudice and hatred, he underestimated the virtues of his enemies or competitors. The eyes of the accurate thinker sees facts, not the delusions of prejudice, hate, and envy. An accurate thinker must be something of a good sportsman, in that he is fair enough, with himself at least, to look for virtues as well as faults in other people. For it is not without reason to suppose that all men have some of each of these qualities. I do not believe that I can afford to deceive others. I know I cannot afford to deceive myself. This must be the motto of the accurate thinker. With the supposition that these habits are sufficient to impress upon your mind the importance of searching for facts until they are reasonably sure that you have found them, we will take up the question of organizing, classifying, and using these facts. Look once more in the circle of your own acquaintances and find a person who appears to accomplish more with less effort than do any of his associates. Study this man and you observe that he is a strategist and that he has learned how to arrange facts so that he brings to his aid the law of increasing returns, which we described in a previous lesson. The man who knows that he is working with facts goes at his task with a feeling of self-confidence, which enables him to refrain from temporizing, hesitating, or waiting to make sure of his ground. He knows in advance what the outcome of his efforts will be. Therefore, he moves more rapidly and accomplishes more than does the man who must feel his way, because he is not sure that he is working with facts. The man who has learned of the advantages of searching for facts as the foundation of his thinking has gone a very long way toward the development of accurate thinking. But the man who has learned how to separate facts into the important and the unimportant has gone still further. The latter may be compared to the man who uses a trip hammer and thereby accomplishes at one blow more than the former, who uses a tack hammer, can accomplish with 10,000 blows. Let us analyze briefly a few men who have made it their business to deal with the important or relevant facts pertaining to their life work. If it were not for the fact that this course is being adapted to the practical needs of men and women of the present workaday world, we would go back to the great work of the past, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Solomon, Moses, and Christ, and direct attention to their habit of dealing with facts. However, we can find examples near our own generation that will serve our purpose to better advantage at this particular point. Inasmuch as this is an age in which money is looked upon as being the most concrete proof of success, let us study a man who has accumulated almost as much of it as any other man in the history of the world, John D. Rockefeller. Mr. Rockefeller has one quality that stands out like a shining star, above all of his other qualities. It is his habit of dealing only with the relevant facts pertaining to his life work. As a very young man, and a very poor young man at that, Mr. Rockefeller adopted as his chief definite aim the accumulation of great wealth. It is not my purpose, nor is it any of my particular advantage, to enter into Mr. Rockefeller's method of accumulating his fortune, other than to observe that it is his most pronounced quality was that of insisting on facts as the basis of his business philosophy. Some there are here who say that Mr. Rockefeller was not always fair with his competitors. That may or may not be true. As accurate thinkers, we leave the point undisturbed. But no one, not even his competitors, ever accused Mr. Rockefeller of forming snap judgment or of underestimating the strength of his competitors. He not only recognized facts that affected his business wherever and whenever they found him, but he made it his business to search for them until he was sure he had found them. Thomas Edison is another great example of a man who has attained a greatness through the organization, classification, and use of relevant facts. Mr. Edison works with natural laws as his chief aids. Therefore, he must be sure of his facts before he can harness those laws. Every time you press a button and switch on an electric light, remember that it was Mr. Edison's capacity for organizing relevant facts which made this possible. Every time you hear a phonograph, remember that Mr. Edison is the man who made it a reality through his persistent habit of dealing with relevant facts. Every time you see a moving picture, remember that it was born of Mr. Edison's habit of dealing with important and relevant facts. In the field of science, relevant facts are the tools with which men and women work. Mere information or hearsay evidence is of no value to Mr. Edison, yet he might have wasted his life working with it, as millions of other people are doing. Hearsay evidence could never have produced the incandescent electric light, the phonograph, or the moving picture, and if it had, the phenomena would have been an accident. In these lessons, we are trying to prepare the student to avoid accidents. The question now arises as to what constitutes an important and relevant fact. The answer depends entirely upon what constitutes your definite chief aim in life. For an important and relevant fact is any fact which you can use without interfering with the rights of others in the attainment of that purpose. All other facts, as far as you are concerned, are superfluous and of minor importance at most. However, you can work just as hard in organizing, classifying, and using unimportant and irrelevant facts as you can in dealing with their opposites, but you will not accomplish as much. Up to this point, we have been discussing only one factor of accurate thought, that which is based upon deductive reasoning. Perhaps this is the point at which some of the students of this course will have to think along lines with which they are not familiar. For we come now to a discussion of thought, which does much more than gather, organize, and combine facts. Let us call this creative thought. That you may understand why it is called creative thought, it is necessary briefly to study the process of evolution through which the thinking man has been created. Thinking man has been a long time on the road of evolution, and he has traveled a very long way. In the words of Judge T. Troward, in Bible Mystery and Bible Meaning, perfected man is the apex of the evolutionary pyramid, and this by a necessary sequence. Let us trace thinking man through the five evolutionary steps through which we believe he has traveled, beginning with the very lowest, namely, the mineral period. Here we find life in its lowest form, lying motionless and inert, a mass of mineral substances with no power to move. Then comes the vegetable period. Here we find life in a more active form, with intelligence sufficient to gather food, grow and reproduce, but still unable to move from its fixed moorings. Then comes the animal period. Here we find life in a still higher and more intelligent form, with ability to move from place to place. Then comes the human or thinking man period, where we find life in its highest known form, the highest because man can think, and because thought is the highest known form of organized energy. In the realm of thought, man knows no limitation. He can send his thoughts to the stars with the quickness of a flash of lightning. He can gather facts and assemble them in new and varying combinations. He can create hypotheses and translate them into physical reality through thought. He can reason both inductively and deductively. Then comes the spiritual period. On this plane, the lower forms of life, described in the previously mentioned four periods, converge and become infinitude in nature. At this point, thinking man has unfolded, expanded, and grown until he has projected his thinking ability into infinite intelligence. As yet, thinking man is but an infant in this fifth period, for he has not yet learned how to appropriate to his own use this infinite intelligence called spirit. Moreover, with a few rare exceptions, man has not yet recognized thought as the connecting link which gives him access to the power of infinite intelligence. These exceptions have been such men as Moses, Solomon, Christ, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Confucius, and a comparatively small number of their type. Since their time, we have had many who partly uncovered this great truth, yet the truth itself is as available now as it was then. To make use of creative thought, one must work very largely on faith, which is the chief reason why more of us do not indulge in this sort of thought. The most ignorant of the race can think in terms of deductive reasoning, in connection with matters of purely physical and material nature. But to go a step higher and think in terms of infinite intelligence is another question. The average man is totally at sea the moment he gets beyond that which he can comprehend with the aid of his five physical senses of seeing, hearing, feeling, smelling, and tasting. Infinite intelligence works through none of these agencies, and we cannot invoke its aid through any one of them. How, then, may one appropriate the power of infinite intelligence is but a natural question. And the answer is, through creative thought. To make clear the exact manner in which this is done, I will now call your attention to some of the preceding lessons of this course, through which you have prepared to understand the meaning of creative thought. In the second lesson, and to some extent in practically every other lesson that followed it, up to this one, you have observed the frequent introduction of the term autosuggestion, suggestion that you make to yourself. We now come back to the term again because autosuggestion is the telegraph line, so to speak, over which you may register in your subconscious mind a description or plan of that which you wish to create or acquire in physical form. It is a process you can easily learn to use. The subconscious mind is the intermediary between the conscious thinking mind and infinite intelligence, and you can invoke the aid of infinite intelligence only through the medium of the subconscious mind, by giving it clear instructions as to what you want. Here you become familiar with the psychological reason for a definite chief aim. If you have not already seen the importance of creating a definite chief aim as the object of your life work, you will undoubtedly do so before this lesson shall have been mastered. Knowing from my own experience as a beginner in the study of this and related subjects, how little I understood such terms as subconscious mind and autosuggestion and creative thought, I have taken the liberty throughout this course of describing these terms through every conceivable simile and illustration, with the object of making their meaning and the method of their application so clear that no student of this course could possibly fail to understand. This accounts for the repetition of terms which you will observe throughout the course, and at the same time serves as an apology to those students who have already advanced far enough to grasp the meaning of much that the beginner will not understand at first reading. The subconscious mind has one outstanding characteristic to which I will now direct your attention. Namely, it records the suggestions which you send it through autosuggestion and invokes the aid of infinite intelligence in translating these suggestions into their natural physical form, through natural means which are in no way out of the ordinary. It is important that you understand the foregoing sentence, for if you fail to understand it, you are likely to fail also to understand the importance of the very foundation upon which this entire course is built, that foundation being the principle of infinite intelligence, which may be reached and appropriated at will through aid of the law of the master mind, described in the introductory lesson. Study carefully, thoughtfully, and with meditation the entire preceding paragraph. The subconscious mind has another outstanding characteristic. It accepts and acts upon all suggestions that reach it, whether they are constructive or destructive, and whether they come from the outside or from your own subconscious mind. You can see, therefore, how essential it is for you to observe the law of evidence and carefully follow the principles laid down in the beginning of this lesson, in the selection of that which you will pass on to your subconscious mind through autosuggestion. You can see why one must search diligently for facts and why one cannot afford to lend a receptive ear to the slanderer and the scandalmonger. For to do so is the equivalent of feeding the subconscious mind with food that is poison and ruinous to creative thought. The subconscious mind may be likened to the sensitive plate of a camera on which the picture of any object placed before the camera will be recorded. The plate of the camera does not choose the sort of picture to be recorded on it. It records anything which reaches it through the lens. The conscious mind may be likened to the shutter which shuts off the light from the sensitized plate, permitting nothing to reach the plate for record except that which the operator wishes to reach it. The lens of the camera may be likened to autosuggestion, for it is the medium which carries the image of the object to be registered to the sensitized plate of the camera. And infinite intelligence may be likened to the one who develops the sensitized plate after a picture has been recorded on it, thus bringing that picture into physical reality. The ordinary camera is a splendid instrument with which to compare the whole process of creative thought. First comes the selection of the object to be exposed before the camera. This represents one's definite chief aim in life. Then comes the actual operation of recording a clear outline of that purpose through the lens of autosuggestion on the sensitized plate of the subconscious mind. Here the infinite intelligence steps in and develops the outline of that purpose in a physical form appropriate to the nature of the purpose. The part which you must play is clear. You select the picture to be recorded, your definite chief aim. Then you fix your conscious mind upon this purpose with such intensity that it communicates with the subconscious mind through autosuggestion and registers that picture. You then begin to watch for and to expect manifestations of physical realization of the subject of that picture. Bear in mind the fact that you do not sit down and wait, nor do you go to bed and sleep with the expectation of awakening to find that infinite intelligence has showered you with the object of your definite chief aim. You go right ahead in the usual way, doing your daily work in accordance with the instructions laid down in Lesson 9 of this course, with full faith and confidence that natural ways and means for the attainment of the object of your definite purpose will open to you at the proper time and in a suitable manner. The way may not open suddenly, from the first step to the last, but it may open one step at a time. Therefore, when you are conscious of an opportunity to take the first step, take it without hesitation, and do the same when the second and the third and all subsequent steps, essential for the attainment of the object of your definite chief aim, are manifested to you. Infinite intelligence will not build you a home and deliver the home to you, ready to enter, but infinite intelligence will open the way and provide the necessary means with which you may build your own home. Infinite intelligence will not command the cashier of your bank to place a definite sum of money to your credit just because you suggested this to your subconscious mind, but infinite intelligence will open to you the way in which you may earn or borrow that money and place it to you your own credit. Infinite intelligence will not throw out the present incumbent of the White House and make you president in his place. But infinite intelligence would most likely proceed, under the proper circumstances, to influence you to prepare yourself to fill that position with credit and then help you to attain it through the regular method of procedure. Do not rely upon the performance of miracles for the attainment of the object of your definite chief aim. Rely upon the power of infinite intelligence to guide you, through natural channels, and with the aid of natural laws for its attainment. Do not expect infinite intelligence to bring you the object of your definite chief aim. Instead, expect infinite intelligence to direct you towards that object. As a beginner, do not expect infinite intelligence to move quickly in your behalf. But as you become more adept in the use of the principle of autosuggestion, and as you develop the faith and understand required for its quick realization, you can create a definite chief aim and witness its immediate translation into physical reality. You did not walk the first time you tried, but now as an adult, an adept at walking,